yesterday when talking about relating to fellow monastics or fellow practitioners, you mentioned like this sort of vertical relationships as well as horizontal relationships.
Right.
For me, that kind of like begs the question about like respect. Like, what is respect? And it almost sounds like there's almost like two different flavors of it or something like that, or how...
Well, I mean...
I think one of the things, because it's... I mean, there's a lot of different flavors of respect, you know, in the sense of because it's one in, and you know, the sense of respect that one has in terms of, well, maybe it's good to sort of even kind of get some boundaries on what respect actually is, in the sense of, because it's one that maybe there's a sense of, I mean, because it has these different sort of flavors of both of deference as well as care and a sense of appreciation. And so there's all these different flavors that are part of respect. And so that because you think in terms of say like Hiri and Otapa, you know, in the sense of you know, what the basis of Hiri and Otapa are, of Hiri being a respect for oneself, and Otapa the basis of having concern is respect for others. So it's a and I think it's not, because sometimes it's a word that's not really used in modern English usage that much, and or cultural usage. I think from a Buddhist perspective and a perspective on training, then there's a sense of, say, like, because of respect, then one is willing to look toward somebody for guidance and example. But then, as one's living with others, then one has a respect for their commitment and their virtue and their sense of being fellow human beings who are suffering, and it's not as if it's one or the other, but it's those are different sort of flavors that go back and forth, really. Because also, just in terms of when one's living with others as fellow monastics and fellow practitioners, you want to be able to have a certain deference and care, that one's looking after each other, and as well as being ready to either hear perspectives on Dhamma, and it's that respect that opens oneself up to hearing perspectives, or hearing guidance, or hearing some kind of feedback. And so, you know, it's quite multifaceted, and I think it's helpful to reflect on it, because I think there is a tendency, and I heard somebody talk about it in, I can't remember, it was fairly recently, about that in modern American usage, respect is something that is sort of kind of fear-based, or like, you know, you're trying to command respect, but basically what you're doing is you're trying to make people, other people fear you. Like in and I heard it in particularly in relationship to like a gaming culture. And so that's a whole different ball game, and is really not what's useful. Because you say something like respect, so like if you think in terms of the Mangala Sutta, Gahala Vocha Niwa Tocha, those are two things that go together, and those are highest blessings. So Karlawa is to being respectful, being respectful of others, towards others, with others, and Niwa Tocha is to is having a certain humility, and so those are quite linked together, and they're not. I don't think they're out of place. I don't think the Buddha put them out of place just for the fun of it, or just to confuse us. So that sense of gharlava there's a quality of humility that is there as a basis, and then the aspect of respect is being conveyed. So yeah, those are helpful things to be considering, and also sort of being attentive to what our cultural conditioning is in that aspect. Make sense? I'm making this up as I go along.
Well, boy, I was poking around the Christian section. didn't take your best attention to follow, but I was... there was an interesting... one of the writers made a very interesting distinction between celibacy and chastity, saying that chastity was sort of the culmination of celibacy, sort of the bringing it to completion. Uh-huh. And I mean, obviously we don't use exactly that language, but I thought there was an interesting, maybe something worth saying around, you know, sort of two levels of the brahmacharya taken to two levels of sort of withdraw from those things, and if there's any...
Not even sure what you say, because there's a, especially in terms of Christian theology, there's probably a very refined articulation of what it means to, what chastity means, or what chaste means, and it's... I don't have the background for that, but I think it's probably a good distinction to make or to reflect on in terms of celibacy being the renunciation of the sexual pursuit and sexual gratification, and then chastity being more of a state of mind that is results from that. And there's there actually there's a sutta. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya of the Buddha talking about the different levels of brahmacharya. I can't remember where it is. If there's five of them, it's in the Anguttara Fives. But where it's where one is withdrawing from the, you know, let's say, keeping the precepts or precept around relinquishment of the, you know, the sexual impulse, but then it's also the you know, not delighting in conversations and contact and seeking that out, and then not delighting in just sort of the observing and getting fascinated in what others are doing, and the so there's different levels of that pulling back from the whole entanglement of sexual and sensual pursuits and the stimulation from that. So then that's maybe more of a, say, akin to a quality, a mind state of a chaste mind state. So that's a good, because it's yeah, one aspect is you know, a pretty crude aspect is just trying to keep the precepts but then the ability of the mind to not get fascinated with memory and proliferation and seeking out stimulation in different ways and then a cultivation of an inner peace and wholeness within oneself, where one is not being pulled into that becoming mode, because it comes back to those roots of the bhavasava. It's sort of the ghamasava is one aspect, but then, you know, that bhavasava, that underlying root of becoming a being, defining oneself, being a somebody who has to be, have somebody else to have to connect with in some way, and so that shift from, so that one's using the celibacy as a foundation, but it has a purpose, and it has it's a helpful tool for one is sort of seeing more clearly those that underlying, the asava, that deeply rooted tendency to sensuality, but then the deeply rooted tendency to becoming, to being, having to be somebody, something.
back to the discussion of respect, one additional element that we seem to be bringing to the West about respect is symbols. In that symbols basically are robes, are goals, are a way we do things. Because it's one thing for Westerners are, I think, more comfortable respecting an individual that they really admire. But then we're doing something beyond that. I wonder if you could speak about that.
Yeah, I think it's, as one, it takes a while to get a feel for that, and to, you know, as one lays that foundation of training, and say like Ajahn Chah, treating your alms bowl as if in the same, giving it the same amount of respect that you would the Buddha's head. And particularly in a Thai culture, just anybody's head you don't mess with. And then it's something that you're respectful of their space and their but then the Buddha's head is something even higher. So I mean that's a symbol of the living holy life. The robes and the something that is you go to Thailand nowadays and there's billboards of cautioning people or asking people not to disrespect Buddha images and either in terms of getting Buddha images and using them as furniture or going to religious sites and crawling all over Buddhas and getting your selfies on your own while you're which it happens. But these are religious, and again, we just don't have that same background, and it isn't something you can just mandate, and you can't tell people to about it. But it's more like I think that's one of the reasons why having a monastery and a monastery environment that is well trained, and then there's a sense of maybe not respect but maybe reverence that people feel toward something that, this is really well done, this is feels right somehow, it feels peaceful, it feels inspiring, and people do. So many people come and they say that, and they're the cement workers, and the guys that come and work on the they feel something, and it's something that it's not ordinary, and so the symbols start to mean something because of the context, and they're helpful. I mean, it's helpful to have symbols. For me, it's like the longer I'm in the robes, the longer I'm in the practice, and actually the more kind of respect I feel for and care that I take around the symbols, and because it becomes increasingly meaningful. Whereas before, I mean, remember when I first. And before I even, I remember going to one of the first times I went to, I was in Laos, in Luang Prabang, and there's this cave where all these Buddha images, and it was just a bunch of images, statues, I'm out of here. it didn't have much of a feel for it at all. So it's just, and that's pretty ordinary. So again, it's not something you can mandate, but it's something that one starts to see how it can be helpful. It's like now if I travel somewhere and I'm not going to be in a monastery, then, well, even if I am, I've got an amulet that I take with me, but it's just a reminder. Or if I'm going to be out of a monastery setting for some reason, I've got a little traveling Buddha shrine that I nicely set up. You know, do I need it? Not really. Do I like it? Yeah. You know, I find it's really, really helpful. I've got something, you know, tangible that I bow to when I go to, you know, in the evening, I bow to in the morning when I do. You know, it's a helpful reminder. Well, those are, they're not critical to my existence, but I find it helps to give a certain beauty of expression. And I think that's something that I can remember so often when Ajahn Chah would say criticize or correct us in our conduct. He wouldn't say, "Oh, it's wrong. You're bad." That's not beautiful. And then there's something about creating beauty in one's life that the monastic training and I think it really facilitates. It gives us an opportunity to create real beauty in the human existence of beautiful conduct, a beautiful shrine, a space that people can come into, and there's a beauty there that is oftentimes, you know, it's easy to forget that the human existence can be a really beautiful experience. And if we're focused on mundane, dreary things, then you know, the life becomes mundane and dreary. But we can actually focus and train ourselves in qualities and things and do things in a very beautiful way it's really uplifting for the heart, and both for ourselves as well as for others. And it's I think it's not a small thing.
I always sometimes when a lay person comes to visit and get tea time or something, and they ask you a question. Sometimes they can be kind of a coarse in their behavior, maybe disrespectful in a sense. But sometimes you don't really say anything to them about that, and then you just kind of whatever, you know. Just keep talking to them and enjoy the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't really point anything out to somebody or teach them if you don't have a fundamental kind of relationship, and they have some feeling of connection in some way. And and if somebody does something just out of not really attuned to the situation or the place, and most people are completely out of tune, but if they're not attuned to it, and then you start, "You should do that." They're out the door and they're gone. And they're not back again. And there's no point in that. And if somebody is not respectful to me, not respectful to the Buddha image. I mean, it doesn't lessen the Buddha image, and it's no skin off my nose. I mean, it just. But it's just sort of, you know, that's not because my existence doesn't depend on you know, or the monastery doesn't depend on it really. I mean, it's just this, we're giving people the opportunity to learn, and if they learn, fine, and if not, fine, and you know, there. And then if people don't learn, then you know, they're going to be gone pretty soon. It's fairly easy.
So, like, so in terms of like manifesting beauty and conduct and sort of manifesting these values and symbols and things, and like also part of that, for like part of like the brahmacharya, like, you know, that the core of that is celibacy. And that for the Buddha was obviously extremely important for his training and his monastics. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking about how, like, you know, we have the Western cultural context, or Western culture has very little context for the, you know, that celibacy is somehow a good thing.
Well, I mean, the exact opposite. I mean, you got, it's I mean, it is something that is. not so familiar, and particularly, you know, I think in general, one would typify American culture as a Protestant culture. So it's even if one's a committed atheist, there's that kind of Protestant value is very strong. So that the I mean, it's something new, but it's not something new in you know, many cultures. In Europe, it's a lot more known, respected. Seen as a good thing, and then of course in Asian culture of India, China, Southeast Asia, and it's very much a value that is seen as ordinary, and you know, being able to because also there isn't a renunciant culture in America. It's a very novel concept. But then there's all sorts of things that are quite novel about the. Say like a Buddhist culture, in the sense of, and particularly Buddhist, as opposed to a spiritual culture, a religious seeker culture in India, which is well known. The aspect of training the mind to be peaceful, I mean, it's something that is not really. It's not a part of modern Western culture, and particularly American culture. And you know, there's enough people around who feel some kind of lack that introducing it is. And the thing is you know, we're not a proselytizing. We're not on a mission, so if people, you know, we sort of set up conditions, and if people are interested, then they can. We're not trying to get anybody to. It's just like that. I mean, one, everybody here came out of their own interest, and. Yeah, and then in 13 days of 2,000 downloads of Ajahn Chah's biography, I mean, there's some interest out there. So It's so that, that even though it's not known or hugely familiar, then but still there really is an interest and a yearning, and even for you know, and similarly for I mean, say like in Thailand, which is, I mean, that's probably one of the stronger Buddhist cultures. But the number of, say, of monastic renunciants that are keeping committed to a celibate lifestyle is a fraction of a percent. It's under 0.1%. You know, so you know, so it's you know, it isn't as if it's expected for. And it never has been, but it does inform the society around. It gives options for people who are either interested in that or interested in the values that make for that quality of clarity or peace or. Yeah. Maybe we should have a bit of a break. We've got to go up the hill for our psalm meeting.
Sadhu.